welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, J. Brian Lauder will be on to discuss women who want to be sterilized but meet resistance from doctors. NPR takes a long look at the AIDS crisis 30 years into it, and red state governors are toying with the idea of rejecting the Affordable Care Act. Last week saw the London Summit on Family Planning, and as part of this kickoff, Melinda Gates and the Gates Foundation made a strongly worded video in support of contraception rights and access around the world.
Giving a woman the simple opportunity to decide for herself when to become a mother is an easy and effective way of letting her determine her own future. And it's much more than that. Information about and access to contraceptives would save the lives of 100,000 mothers and prevent 600,000 children from dying every year. Deciding when to become a mother allows girls to stay in school and women to work. Family planning programs boost education and the economy, giving developing countries the resources to help themselves. It's a health initiative that makes financial sense. Every $1 that we invest in family planning could save $6 that we'd spend on housing, healthcare, and public services.
The research showing that contraception could reduce the maternal mortality rate in developing countries by one-third is getting a lot of play, which is great. The statistic about children shows exactly who in this fight actually cares about the lives of children. Three decades into the AIDS epidemic, NPR decided to do a series of stories about the current state of HIV and AIDS, the research, the outreach, the policy, and the people who live with it, and those who died of it, which is something that surprisingly doesn't get talked about as much as it used to. Part of that is because people with HIV now have access to drugs that can keep them alive, often for decades, without ever actually having the virus develop into AIDS. I think sometimes that leads us to forget that AIDS is an extremely fatal disease, and if it's not treated, is nearly completely fatal, but for a few rare cases, and fatal in a rapid period of time between infection and death. But that topic was directly addressed in a piece about the AIDS quilt, where they interviewed people memorializing their lost loved ones.
Well, a group of us, about 25 of us in Atlanta, were very, very close friends. We decided to memorialize our friend Kenneth, and we started in October of last year. When we first began making what we thought was going to be one panel, actually turned into eight panels. And so eight panels actually create an entire 12 by 12 foot block. So we knew that we wanted to put our friendship and the way that we hang out together and the way that we love each other on there. And then we also wanted to put, like, Kenneth's fashion sense on there because he was huge into fashion, and he loved, loved, loved clothes. So when we first started doing it, we just thought that we were just going to make one with just fashion and just his pictures and stuff and our pictures together. And then it actually turned into three panels that particular day.
Of course, the death rate from AIDS just isn't what it used to be. Though how long you have to live after being diagnosed with HIV depends on a lot of factors. Health insurance, class status, race, sexual identity, profession, other health factors. You could go on for days about it. But absolutely, it's not a death sentence like it used to be. And the reason for that is drugs, full stop. HIV drugs keep the virus from taking over your system and have a side effect of making you less contagious. Though if you're HIV positive, you should always use condoms and not take a chance. NPR did a couple of reports on how these drugs have pretty much been a miracle in places where AIDS fatalities literally threaten to destroy their communities and even their nations. Botswana, for instance, was looking at HIV rates of 25% of adults and took serious measures.
Part of the reason Botswana's HIV treatment program has been effective is that the country moved relatively quickly to address the epidemic. In 2002, Botswana became the first nation in Africa to launch a program to try to provide access to HIV drug treatment nationwide. Now, roughly 95% of Botswana's citizens who need the medications are on them.
This is a remarkable achievement to have virtually universal coverage of everyone who needed to be treated.
Kathleen Toomey is the head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's office in Botswana.
From the beginning of the epidemic here, there's been tremendous leadership on the part of the government of Botswana to address the epidemic head on.
Now, the culture of daily AIDS funerals has really turned around, mostly due to internal government intervention with the help of some outside funding sources. Not every nation has as many resources as Botswana, however, and so getting that level of help out to their citizens requires wealthier nations to step in and help out. To everyone's great surprise, it was President Bush, of all people, who spearheaded such a program called PEPFAR. Now, I've been critical of PEPFAR on this program, especially regarding concerns that they weren't invested enough in preventing transmission of HIV. But the whole thing has been pretty successful in keeping people from dying of AIDS around the world, as NPR reports by focusing on how well it's working in Haiti.
Today, there are thousands and thousands of modern-day Lazaruses in Haiti, and fewer these days are getting to the final stages of AIDS before they're rescued by HIV drugs.
Michel Oxan.
In Haiti's sprawling capital of Port-au-Prince, Dr. Vanessa Rousier shows me around the country's biggest AIDS clinic.
It's one of our busiest clinics where we see over 200 patients per day.
One reason it's so busy is that being infected with HIV has lost a lot of the terrifying social stigma the disease had when it was always fatal.
People can come and be comfortable about coming because, yes, we've done a lot of promotion to decrease stigma, but also because they know that there is something that can be done for them, and it's free, and it's available, and it works.
NPR also looked closer to home, because while HIV has faded from the public imagination as a real problem here, there's still an AIDS crisis that isn't getting the coverage it deserves. More than 1 million Americans have HIV, which amounts to 1 in 300, which falls well below where it's at in some more AIDS-ravaged countries, but is something to be extremely concerned about. Unfortunately, one reason perhaps the HIV epidemic doesn't get the attention it deserves is that black people are disproportionately infected by, like, a whole lot.
If black America were a country, it would have the 16th highest HIV infection rate in the world.
Robert Fullilove, a professor of sociomedical studies at Columbia, talks some more on Terry Gross's show about the extent of the problem.
When I started doing this work in 1986, roughly 27% of all the people in the United States who were living with AIDS were African American. The most recent statistics from the Centers for Disease Control indicate that 45% of all the new cases of HIV infection are amongst African Americans. It is the primary killer for those in the 19 to 44 age group. It is especially devastating with women. It is continuing to be one of the leading causes of death, and in the panoply, in the group of what the Centers for Disease Control calls health disparities, HIV/AIDS is ranked way up in the top five as one of the most important and most preventable causes of death currently challenging life in the African American community.
30 years into the epidemic, we have reasons to hope, but also so much more work to do. Only half the people worldwide who need HIV drugs are getting them. And even in our wealthy nation, certain populations are seeing their HIV transmission rates rising. With all the wealth and education we have, this shouldn't be happening. I'd like to welcome J. Brian Lauder to the program. Brian is an editorial assistant at Slate and a frequent blogger at XX Factor, where I also blog. He recently wrote a piece for Slate about the troubles facing women who don't have children and want to make sure they never have them, titled Sterilize Me, Please. Welcome to RealityCast, Brian.
Hi, Amanda.
So, just to start with, describe the kind of woman that you interviewed for this piece.
Well, maybe it's best that I explain how we kind of got interested in doing the piece in the first place. Because many of these women actually came to us. It wasn't that we thought this out. So what happened was we did a whole series of essays, reader-generated essays, from women who wanted to be child-free, who were child-free, wanted to remain child-free. And many of those women sought sterilization as a way to make that choice permanent. And in receiving all these essays and then reading that readers posted on them, we found out that a lot of women actually encounter a huge amount of resistance from their doctors when they request this kind of procedure. So we were just, we're very curious about why that is, because it, you know, it's an elective procedure. We didn't understand why, as long as everyone was medically fit for the procedure, why it should be a problem. And so, yeah, I started looking into why this might be, and interviewed a couple of our readers and some doctors to try to figure that out.
And what I thought was interesting in the piece was that ACOG has actually weighed in on the topic of sterilizing childless young women. And their recommendations were actually pretty in line with what you were saying about why not. So could you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the ACOG recommendation to doctors is to basically, you know, do individualized counseling with each patient. But if that person, you know, ultimately decides that this is the option for them, and does not think that other long-acting contraception is what they need, they do recommend that you that doctors go ahead and do it. The problem that we've seen, though, that our readers have seen, is that doctors aren't actually practicing that in their clinics necessarily, and are either just outright refusing to do the procedure or referring their patients to other doctors who then refer them to other doctors, and on and on and on. So there seems to be a disconnect between the kind of advisory bodies and the actual doctor, the clinician's practices.
So why are so many doctors rejecting the ACOG recommendations and either refusing to sterilize childless young women or just giving them the runaround?
Yeah, I mean, that's the key question. It seems that what's going on is mostly tied to the issue of regret. So there have been a number of studies in the past 20 years or so that have focused on regret in women, especially women who have this procedure done under the age of 30. And the studies have shown that women who have it done at a younger age tend to regret it later in life. And, you know, the statistics are in the story for that. I believe it's something like 20% of women who have it done under 30 are likely within, I believe, 14 years to come back and regret it and maybe request information about a reversal or some other option. So doctors are very concerned about regret. And what I found in my reporting and my research was basically some doctors consider future regret to be doing harm to the patient. So even if you came in as a, you know, as a 24, 25 year old woman asking for this procedure, very sure of yourself, you know, you'd made a decision, they have these stats to show that you're very likely to possibly come back in 10 years and regret it. And they would consider, some would consider causing that regret to even to your future self to actually be doing harm. And, you know, as most people know, doctors have kind of an oath not to do harm. So they're left in this kind of complicated ethical situation, where some believe, you know, that they don't want to cause patients to go through the emotional pain that they may experience later in life. Now, of course, you know, that doesn't help a 20-something woman who is quite certain and may not actually have that regret later, but it's kind of, it's definitely a disconnect between the patient and the doctor.
Well, I think it's interesting because, like, you usually don't, like, hear about regret and surgical procedures, but the other one that the word regret is tossed around a lot about is abortion. You know, the anti-abortion movement is big on saying, like, abortion should be restricted because they believe women regret it, which is actually statistically unlikely. But do you think that there's, like, a thread between these?
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of my interview subjects actually mentioned the connection for her. Anyway, when she went to her doctors, one of the arguments that she made for being sterilized was that if she became pregnant, she would, you know, she would probably have an abortion because she just, you know, doesn't want kids. And interestingly enough, the doctors were more, seemed from her perspective, seemed to be more comfortable with the idea of her having, you know, one or more abortions than getting the sterilization done. So you know, the regret thing is definitely present in both. And I think even with sterilization, there's something even more intense going on about, you know, some old idea that a woman's destiny is in motherhood. There's, you know, there's a lot of that going on, I think, but that is connected or involved in these debates for sure.
Well, and it's just practical too. I mean, you can kind of undo an abortion. I mean, you can't undo an abortion, but you can always get pregnant again. Whereas sterilization is really hard to reverse.
It's very hard to reverse, and that's one of the points that my interview subject stuff, the doctors I interviewed, made, was that getting, or, you know, reversal is possible, but it's often unsuccessful and very expensive. And you know, it's a mess to try to deal with that later. So they really are hesitant. Some of them are really hesitant to do the procedure in the first place because of that.
Do you think that sexism plays a role in all of this?
You know, it's funny, when I started on this piece, that was definitely a suspicion. I wondered, you know, if male gynecologists were reacting differently than female gynecologists to their patients. And as far as I can tell, that's actually not exactly what's going on. There is a study that I cite in the piece that was a survey of a bunch of gynecologists across the United States. And that study or survey did find that there's no difference in terms of sex in how a gynecologist responds to a patient seeking sterilization. And one of the gynecologists I interviewed in the piece, or actually both of them are actually women. And they were pretty measured about the procedure. One of them, you know, said that, of course, it's the patient's decision and she would never say no. And the other said that she strongly discourages them, though in the end she will do the procedure if the patient insists on it. And so, you know, it's hard to know what's going on in individual practices. There's no way, you know, really for us to know that, but all sort of studies have shown that it's not gender-based necessarily.
So do you think, one of the things I thought was also interesting about the piece was that you felt like a lot of women were coming to you with stories about feeling condescended to and lectured by their mm-hmm. physicians, and you felt like that might be a miscommunication issue.
Yeah. I mean, definitely a lot. I mean, the overwhelming majority of the comments that we got back that cited this problem, the women felt that it was, you know, they used the word paternalistic a lot or condescending, and they didn't understand why their physician was kind of, well, they, yeah, like you say, lecturing them this way. The word that the physicians would use is counseling. So they would say that for a procedure like this, an intense amount of counseling is necessary given the permanence of the procedure, you know, that the fact that there are some small surgical risks. It is a surgery, so it's a fairly easy surgery, but it's not nothing. You know, sometimes it's a non-trivial kind of surgery. And so they would say that, you know, that they feel obligated as physicians to counsel their patients as much as possible. And it seemed like a lot of the women the patients we were talking to, you know, did respond to that negatively. And so it raises the question, which I kind of point to in the article, about, you know, what do we expect our healthcare providers to do? Are they merely facilitators, and do we just expect them to do whatever we want when we say it, or do we want them to actually be advising us? And there seems to be a little bit of disagreement, maybe, about what that role is.
My guest today has been Brian Lauder. The piece is called Sterilize Me, Please, and it was published at Slate on July 9th. So you can go over there and check it out. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me.
For those of us who thought the fight over the Affordable Care Act was all over but the whining after the recent Supreme Court decision upholding pretty much every item in the act, well, we should have known better. The right doesn't go gently into that good night, and frankly, this is one of the ugliest and most avid bouts of right-wing resistance to new legislation since the battle over the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It's not just the end-of-the-world rhetoric that's on talk radio and no doubt clogging up your Facebook feed from your right-wing friends. The right is organizing forces to undermine and chip away at this legislation in every way that they can. And the first strategy out the door is red state governors declaring they won't play along. Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana was first out of the gate testing the waters. He said that Louisiana will not accept a Medicaid extension and will not be setting up a state exchange for health insurance. This, weirdly, was his justification.
We've seen promise after promise broken by this president when it comes to health care. My real concerns, not just the cost of actually running the exchanges, but what it does to premiums, what it does to employers in Louisiana, what it does to our taxpayers. Think about all the promises that have been broken. The president said premiums would go down $2,500. That went up 9% last year, according to Kaiser. He said that he was going to leave Medicare alone, protect Medicare. That CMS's actuary says the cuts are not sustainable, not realistic. He said people wouldn't lose their plans or doctors. Some estimates, as many as 20 million Americans could lose their health care, their employer-provided health care coverage. He has made promise after promise that's not being kept in Obamacare, in this health care law. I think the real cost of the exchanges will be higher health care costs, lower quality of health care, more government intrusion in micromanaging health care.
Wow, that was a bunch of nonsense in what sounded like one breath. First of all, premiums went up, yes, but that's before the reforms were actually implemented, and so could have nothing to do with the ACA. The claim that Medicare won't be protected is just strange, and the source is no one I've heard of before. The Congressional Budget Office director has actually said even though it's only starting to be implemented, the ACA is slowing down Medicare spending. The claim that 20 million Americans will lose health insurance is unsourced, but I suspect he's talking about the Americans expected to drop their employer insurance and instead buy from the exchanges because they got a better deal. I hardly see how that's a problem. And he never addresses, not for a second, why any of this should mean that his state will reject allowing people that make up to 133% of the poverty line to get on Medicaid. If he's concerned about actually getting health care to people, that's a way to do it that doesn't involve premiums, employers, or any of the other concerns he mentions at all. Even though Governor Jindal's excuse for refusing to cooperate with the feds on this one made not one bit of sense, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have another equally right-wing governor following right behind him.
Governor Rick Perry sending a letter today to the Obama administration saying Texas will not implement some key provisions of the health care overhaul. They include the Medicaid expansion and the state exchanges.
As you can imagine, Rick Perry was equally inept at explaining why, while pretending he's even remotely interested in getting the 25% of Texans that don't have health insurance into a health care plan.
If anyone had any doubt, we wanted to put it clearly to bed that Texas wasn't going to be a part of it, expanding, socializing of our medicine. So we're not going to participate in exchanges. We're not going to expand Medicaid. We're just not going to be a part of, again, socializing health care in the state of Texas and going in direct conflict with our founding fathers' wishes and freedom, for that matter. People need to be free to make those decisions about their health care, not be forced by this administration into these exchanges.
You can drop the word socializing as much as you want, but that doesn't change the fact that this bill has nothing to do with socializing anything, though I wish that it did. Canada and England have so-called socialized health care, and the people there pay ridiculously low premiums into a single-payer system that is much easier to navigate than most insurance companies. This bill simply makes it easier and more affordable to buy private insurance and gets rid of some of the red tape. But there isn't a government-owned insurance company you pay into. It just isn't, no matter how much conservatives imply otherwise. Additionally, the claim that exchanges reduce freedom is the opposite of true. The point of the exchanges is to put all the insurers in one bucket so they have to compete on a, wait for it, free market that allows consumers to make the best choice for themselves. If you really believe in a free marketplace that maximizes consumer choice, you should love this bill. One in four Texans is uninsured. Perry may want to pretend that this is about coming up with a better system, but he's not offering one. The current performance of Texas suggests instead that he just doesn't care. It's also worth noting that by rejecting the responsibility to put together state exchanges, Texas and Louisiana are both letting the federal government swoop in and create exchanges for them. They claim they're all about local government and taking the power out of federal hands, but by doing this, they're actually moving more government to the federal level. I fully expect more governors to follow suit, though in the long run, there's a reason to believe the rejection of the Medicaid expansion, which will leave 1.8 million Texans uninsured alone, won't last forever. Few states refuse free money for very long. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Rush Limbaugh says what he really means edition. You probably heard this, but if you didn't...
When women got the right to vote, when it all went downhill. Because that's when votes started being cast with emotion and maternal instincts that government ought to reflect.
Well, you know, before 21, the 18-year-olds, they only know their only financial knowledge is, hey, I need money, I'll ask mom for it. And with the state of education these days, I'm not sure there's that much history or government talk.
Yeah, I'm joking about the women's vote. I just a little frustrated here.
I love that he tries to pass it off as a joke, but you can tell from the tone of his voice that he wasn't joking. He got caught up in a game of right-wing one-upmanship with a caller who wants to raise the voting age to 21 and got caught out saying something he sounds like he says in private all the time.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.